Hello and welcome to the Texas Tribune Tribcast for the first week of February. I'm reporter Reeve Hamilton. Joining me is CEO and Editor-in-Chief Evan Smith.
Hey, Reeve.
Managing Editor Ross Ramsey.
Where's Elise?
And Ben Philpott, KUT and the Texas Tribune.
Well, she joined NPR.
She didn't join NPR yet. She just happens to be out of town.
We can say that, though.
She will soon join the staff of NPR.
Okay.
Right, but in the meantime...
NPR gets Elise, we get Reeve.
I gave her a tote bag before she left town.
Did you give her a tote bag?
That's what did it, okay.
Now that we've cleared
Reeve, you've lost control already.
I know, already. Everyone's out of control. But so this week we'll be discussing first the budget, the structural deficit therein, the repeal or non-repeal, whatever will happen with Obamacare, the Howard Neal race, and if we still have time, I'm going to ask if a smoking ban is soon to come for the state of Texas. Okay, but first of all, I was watching the budget hearing this morning in the Senate Finance Committee, and it was like a nursery. I mean, what's going on in there?
Well, I mean, this week we started the budget hearings in the Senate where they have a finance committee. The House doesn't have committees yet and won't until at least the end of next week. So, you know, we'll wait for a while over there. And the Senate's going through this exercise. They always start with the Comptroller's Office. John Hellerman came in. He's the chief revenue estimator for the state, working for Susan Combs. And they pressed him on this idea of how we got here. And the structural deficit is this thing that people talk about in the Capitol. It's a yawner, but it's really important. And it's basically the difference between the amount of money the state promised to spend for local school taxes to not, you know, they said if you lower local school taxes, we'll fill the hole. This is in 2006. And in order to do that, they revised the state's business franchise tax. Well, those numbers don't match up. Turns out that the business franchise tax doesn't cover the price, and they actually knew this at the time, but it's actually worse than they thought because the business franchise tax isn't bringing in the money they expected. The price of the school tax has gone up because property values have gone down. It's kind of a complicated formula. But the bottom line here is that built into our budget for years to come is a $10 billion hole. Every time we start a budget, we're going to start with a $10 billion hole. That's the structural deficit. The other thing that's going on in these hearings, it's kind of I think we're going to see more of, is they start with this pile of numbers. And it all sounds like big numbers, and it is big numbers, but it's not really personalized. And John Whitmire in the Senate and some other senators are kind of trying to humanize these numbers. If you cut $5 billion from public education, and there's 5 million public education students, it's $1,000 a kid. It's $30,000 a classroom. If you cut this much money from this program, it does this to this many people. And we're going through that process. And I think that's one of the reasons it looked like a nursery. They had a bunch of kids over there whose benefits were about to be
cut. But the question is, how specific do you have to get before this becomes real? We're used to the gimmickry of politics where you humanize something ostensibly to put a face on it, but right. We're also cynical these days.
Kind of the Tiny Tim effect.
Well, it's the State of the Union presidential box effect. You know, right. You put as many people up in the box. Didn't Reagan do this first? It was the guy who pulled people out of the Potomac when the plane crash happened, Lenny Skutnik.
Skutnik, yeah.
Lenny Skutnik.
Wow.
He was the first person, I think,
Evan Smith on the warning track.
Thank you very much.
Yeah,
I did pull it out. I exactly right. They put somebody up in the box to illustrate something they want to talk about. And the problem is we're on to them now. You know, right. This last State of the Union, the president had tons of people up in the box. He didn't talk about them by name.
Well, and all you really have to do is be the most recent headliner to get in that box, right?
Right.
You could be the guy that jumped into the subway just the day before.
So my fear is that these kids at the Capitol have a Lenny Skutnik problem. You know, we're so cynical about the humanizing of politics that we don't pay attention to them.
But the problem with talking about a $180 or $190 billion budget is that it's an incomprehensible number, and you've got to basically say, well, what are we getting for that? You know, what exactly is it?
Well, Ben found this out this week when he traveled to nursing homes that were on the verge of being cut. Right.
These are nursing homes that could be cut.
It's not homes that are going to be cut. It's grandma that's going to be cut.
Right. Grandma that's going to be cut, and you know, daughter and grandson-in-law don't have any clue. I mean, they're not a poor family. This one family I talked about, but you know, at the same time, nobody is prepared to be a full-time nursing home at home, and especially you have people at the nursing home that have no family, that the clothes they wear are donated to them by different groups that help out the nursing home. You know, nobody comes to visit them, and what happens if their Medicaid gets cut off, and or not cut off, but the reimbursement rates get cut, the nursing home decides to close. These are people that literally have nowhere else to go.
Except for, are they going to be coming to the Capitol when that part of the bill gets discussed?
Somebody like that is. I mean, you know, the way we deal with problems, I mean, the way we understand problems is to humanize them. That's why we know who Susan Komen is. And that's why we know, you know, we have the Brian Song story. And we have, you know, you take somebody, you make an example of them, you say, this is what's happening.
Right.
We wouldn't know what that disease was if Lou Gehrig hadn't had it.
But the example doesn't produce more money than exists now to be spent.
It gives you a better understanding of what it is that
the impact of the cut is.
What it is that you're doing.
But come back to what you said at the beginning. We have a structural deficit. We've allowed a situation in this state where we have not enough money coming in the door to pay for all the things we say we need to pay for. And if we're not willing to look at new revenue sources, then this is a structural deficit that's going to persist, and we're going to be back here 2 years from now.
Right. You either have to make a permanent cut somewhere that equals the size of this hole, or you have to find some other kind of revenue that fills this hole so that at least you start, other things being equal, economies and all of that kind of stuff, you start somewhere near level ground.
Look at the superintendents this week who are in Austin to meet, and they started to basically shake their fists at the legislature and said, don't you come after us. Don't you put these cuts in place. I mean, the reality is those guys are going to get it, and the kids are going to get it. They're just going to get it. I mean, you can spend a lot of time arguing. You can spend a lot of time making yourself the example. But at the end of the day, those people are going to get their benefits cut dramatically.
How much of that fist shaking should be directed at the people responsible for the changes in 2006 in the first place that didn't pan out the way they expected to? Should we be mad at them, or is that just, oh, well, things happened?
Well, they knew what they were doing. The last fiscal note on the bill in 2006, Carol Strayhorn at the time was the controller, and she was running for governor. Because she was running for governor, all the other Republicans were mad at her and not really listening to her. But the last fiscal note before they voted in 2006 said, this thing is $5 billion a year underwater. Over 5 years, it's $25 billion underwater. The only thing that was wrong with that was that we had a recession and the franchise tax hasn't played like it would, and it actually was bigger than $25 billion. But she was essentially right, and they voted for it. So, yeah, they own it. But part of this is, you know, this continuing problem in the Texas legislature of, and this happens elsewhere too, they have promised to do more than they're willing to pay for. And you've got to reconcile that at some point.
Well, you know, when I was talking to some of the family members out at the nursing home, the story was about trying to put the human face on it, not about the politics behind it. But I did ask them, a couple of them, you know, the idea of, you know, the reason we have these proposed budgets is because there is a group of lawmakers who have gone to the Capitol with the idea that they were sent there for something specific. That specifically is cut everything without any revenue in terms of making up the budget hole. You know, do you think that there needs to be a reshaping of the idea of what they're there to do? You know, ask this to the people. And, you know, I still got two or three answers of people saying, well, you know, I'm sure there are other things to cut. I'm sure there are frivolous things that are in this budget that we could cut instead. So it still wasn't, well, first
well,
of all,
they just don't understand that there's not a lot of money to cut. And
right.
Of the money that's available to cut, it's all in, we've said this how many times, Ross, three right. pockets: public ed, higher ed, health and human services.
And if those people don't get it or don't decide that it's an important thing to do and don't make that clear to their lawmakers, yep, then the lawmakers won't feel pushed to do anything other than what they've got right now.
You know, maybe the movie analog here is 127 hours. You know, sooner or later, I know you like your arm, but how long do you want to stay down here?
Yeah.
Well,
I think that worked.
Yeah, okay, good.
Well, speaking of putting a face to the name of something else people are
angry about.
Right. This is something new for the Tripcast, but we have audio of Attorney General Greg Abbott talking about Obamacare.
There are many laudable aspects of the health care reform law that were passed. However, it's important for all of America to understand, no matter how noble the cause may be, it doesn't authorize Congress to pursue unconstitutional, illegal means to achieve that noble goal.
So earlier this week, a federal judge said that Obamacare is unconstitutional because of its individual mandate issue. You know, is it going to be repealed, basically?
Well, let's talk about the legal aspects and the political aspects of it, and then see if we can square the two. The fact is that at this stage in any long fight, and the healthcare reform fight is a long fight, there are going to be court rulings that are going to make you think that it's heading in one direction, and we're going to turn around and find out that it's not. Now, this is the beginning, not the end, of the court fight over this. There are going to be appeals. There's going to be a lot of different ways to go. We've actually already had some contradictory rulings. Some judges have said that it is constitutional. Some have said
it's
that
two,
it's not.
Two to two
right now.
So this one ruling in Florida, which, of course, the opponents of so-called Obamacare are, you know, jumping up and down, dancing on the graves of this thing. The reality is, it isn't dead. It's simply a favorable ruling for their side. It's not certain what's going to happen.
And both sides have said that the other are mining for judges that will rule in their favor.
Imagine that, right? Yeah, you can't imagine that would be happening. But the political argument is as interesting as the legal argument. The reality is that the Republicans, for all their successes in November, still do not have the numbers in Congress to get this thing repealed legislatively. Yes, they passed a repeal in the House, but not by a veto-proof margin. Even if they had one, they probably don't have the votes. They'd have to get some Democrats to join them. They probably do not have the votes in the Senate to pass this bill. They certainly don't have a veto-proof majority in the Senate. And even if it ends up on the president's desk, he's going to, of course, veto it. So there are many ways in which politically this health care reform repeal is a non-starter. I think the more interesting question is, what do people out in the world want? There was a poll over the last couple of weeks that showed that the highest percentage of Americans favor the health care reform law, the changes made, the Obamacare changes that everybody's jumping up and down about. A higher percentage of people support it now than at any point since it's passed. I mean, the fact is, I'm not sure if the opposition to this reform effort is as great among the masses as it is among the classes.
Well, one of the political arguments, strategy arguments, is that the longer this fight goes and the more things from the healthcare law that become enacted, the more people realize what the bill does for them.
Right.
And if they determine that what the bill does for them is positive, then they'll be less inclined to get rid of it.
Well, the politics change from somebody who came in to fix a problem you might or might not have been aware of to someone taking away your benefit.
Right.
Well, or in fact, taking away a change that was made that has a huge benefit for you. For instance, what the Democrats and the president get to say now, primarily the Democrats because they were the ones who supported the bill, is when they go out with a repeal bill, okay, so these guys over here who are repealing, they want it to be that pre-existing conditions now knock you off insurance. They now want your 26-year-old kid to be off your insurance. They're going to talk about all the things that directly affect people.
Right.
In some ways, this is like the conversation we had about the budget. It's one thing to talk about government. It's another thing to talk about cutting your government.
On the other hand, the other argument is that the federal government's overreaching. However good the benefits it offers might be, that really you just have to cut them back at some point and say, listen, you can't go any further here.
Yeah.
And that's part of the argument here. And I think what both sides are doing, you know, it doesn't matter which judge you go through. Everybody's trying. It's a race to the Supreme Court.
And I actually think that the politics of this, I mean, let's just get down to brass tacks here. The politics of this are great for Greg Abbott. Greg Abbott is a champion of the proposition that the federal government should get out of our business. That puts him squarely in league with Rick Perry. It positions him perfectly to be the logical inheritor of the Perry mantle in 2014 and to run for governor. He is likely to run for governor and have no opposition at all in the Republican primary. Abbott is likely to be the next governor of Texas. And he will use this attack on the Fed's creeping involvement in Texas, not just the health care reform bill, but the EPA and every other thing that the feds do, it's going to accrue to his great benefit.
Is it possible that by that time that the political tide among the people will have shifted?
I think it matters.
Yeah, but Abbott won't have voted for or against the health care bill. He'll have just voted to keep the state's supremacy in this fight between the state and the feds.
And who in Texas is going to say we should give up all of our rights to the federal government? Nobody. No matter how you feel about health care reform, Abbott has a position that politically is very good.
And he could always say, I like the health care bill. I think it's a great idea. He could even say, I think we should have universal health care. I just don't think that they should assert themselves in this manner.
I don't think this is the bill. Right. I mean, remember, Texas has more uninsured people than any state in the rest of the country.
Right.
But that aside, Abbott can argue not whether to have a bill. He can argue whether to have this bill.
He can skirt the messaging problem that some of the other Republicans do have.
Yeah. Right. Another Republican looking to get into office is Dan Neal. He's been working on his appeal.
That was a nice transition, Reed.
Oh, well, thank you. He's been working on his appeal to get his Donna Howard seat. Ben, I believe you've been reporting on that. Is this a waste of time or is this a legitimate issue to be concerned with?
I don't think that it's a waste of time. I mean, you hear all the time about people saying, you know, look, we need to make sure that all of our elections are fair, that, you know, people who do have the right to vote are voting, people who don't have the right to vote aren't voting.
Of course, who's for unfair elections? Nobody.
Right.
This is a motherhood
Chicago?
Segment.
I mean, is that, can I say that? Okay. Anyway.
No, you can't.
But, you know, and you get that even when, you know, we've got a little bit of sound from both Howard, from Daniel and Donna Howard. You know, you hear Donna Howard talking about that in these clips. And let's go ahead and listen to one. The first one you're going to hear, Dan Neal answering a reporter's question, talking about, you know, how much money is he spending on this defense?
Nothing in here is free. I found out nothing in running a campaign is free. And yes, there's been a lot of money involved in this, but ultimately doing it, I feel it's the right thing to do. And you know, I think it's going to be upwards of you know, I'd say probably around $100,000 when it's all said and done.
Is it worth it?
Get to the bottom of it, yeah. Yeah, it is to me.
Well, I think it's absolutely appropriate that we look at the legitimacy of votes. I have no problem with that whatsoever. I have a lot of respect for my colleagues here in the House, and I believe that the vast majority of the people here want to do what's right. They will look at the facts and make a decision based on the facts.
And, you know, the last thing that Donna Howard was saying, that's alluding back to the idea of we've got a Republican master of discovery in Will Hartnett. We've got a committee that will then oversee whatever his recommendation is, which has a Republican majority, and then, of course, there is a gigantic Republican majority in the state House. She was asked that question about whether or not she was worried about politics, partisanship playing a role in this. I think that if you have not paid attention, you might think that that's an issue. But in 2005, Will Hartnett was master of discovery for another contested election where a Democratic challenger had just ousted Appropriations Chair Talmadge Heflin.
This is the Hubert Vaux
Talmadge
Heflin race.
And you had Tom Craddock in the Speaker's chair, who I think no matter what you think about Joe Strauss, Tom Craddock ran the House with a much stronger grip than Joe Strauss did. And yet in that case, you still had Will Hartnett coming out. His recommendation was that Hubert Vaux was the winner.
What was the margin of the election
30,
there?
I think 33 votes was what they had going into the challenge.
That's just under triple what we have this time.
It was tight. Yeah, I mean, you know, elections always have some slop in them. I mean, the fact is that there's always some slop. And when you get a result that's close, then the lawyers on both sides say, well, we really should press and see if this will go our way or the other way. There's 12 votes in this race out of about 50,000 cast. The House has done this 14 or 15 times in the last 30 years. And with one exception, they've always gone with the person that you thought was the winner on election
day. That was certified the winner. Right.
The one exception was they ordered a new election, and the person who you thought was the winner on election day, in fact, won that special election. So
in fact, no challenger who has pressed a challenge has ended up in the House.
In the last 30 years.
In the last 30 years.
Right. If let's say they did this one time, it was very fairly decided that Neal was the winner. Does that mean, I mean, Donna Howard is representing that district right now. She's filed a bunch of bills. I guess Dan Neal would come in. Those bills would get erased. At what point would he come in, and would he have time to even file bills that would have a decent shot at getting anywhere?
Somebody could pick up her bills. Her bills would fall away, but somebody could pick up those bills.
Not likely Neal.
He could He could file bills if he wanted to. And in fact, there will be some bills probably in that set that she filed that he would file. We need a low water crossing over here, or we need school, you know, whatever it is. There's things of interest
local
in the district
and consent stuff
that have nothing to do
not
with
not everything
politics,
is
right?
Hyper-partisan?
Not everything. Sure. Not yet. And they passed this rule. There used to be a rule in the Texas House that if you were in an election contest, your seniority went away for purposes of committees and stuff. So had they kept the old rules, Donna Howard would have lost her seniority just because of this challenge. They changed that rule. So having changed it, it means that Dan Neal comes in, if he wins this election, with her seniority.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Interesting.
That's pretty good.
Oh, good deal.
So he goes back for, what is she now? She's been in for...
This would be her third term.
Third term.
So well, or second and a half. She was a special election.
So he becomes a second...
Right. It probably doesn't play so much this time, but you know, you get a couple of sessions down the road when you're into seniority appointments and things, and that plays.
So as I understood from Ben's piece on KUT and in the Tribune... Hartnett decides in a couple days what he recommends, but then he sends it to a special committee appointed by Strauss.
Yes.
And then the committee decides what to do with Hartnett's recommendation.
Yes, and then it goes to the House for a vote, kind of like a bill. You know, it's like it's Hartnett's bill. It goes to the committee right. looks at it, and then the committee sends it on to the whole House. Now, that it did not get that far with Talmadge Heflin. As soon as the recommendation came out,
Heflin
which said Vaux is the winner, in my opinion, Heflin pulled out.
And so it's sort of like a jury in that it is their opinion. They could be wrong, but that's the decision that we're going to live with.
Well, and it's weird. Both opinions can go up. The House can look at Hartnett's opinion if the committee disagrees with him. And they can also look at a minority report out of the committee. I mean, all of this is sort of a fact-finding mission.
Right.
And the House can consider all of this stuff when they get up there.
Are you aware of a situation in which the special master and the committee have recommended one thing and the House voted the other way?
Yeah, the House, I can't remember the race, but they voted for the minority report in a couple of these.
Yeah.
The Texas Legislative Council, which is sort of a built-in legal and research arm over there, has this great webpage. If you go to their website, tlc.state.tx.us, and poke around, you can read the history of these things. There was one or maybe two minority reports adopted.
So the fact is, even if Hartnett says she's for Howard,
right,
he's for Howard, and if the committee says they're for Howard, Howard's not out of the woods until the House votes.
As long as Neil has not dropped out at some point,
right. Yes. As long as this is pressed, the House vote is the final vote.
They should just get a trio of psychic human type people to live in a bath, like the movie Minority Report. That's how they
wonder
decide things there.
That, yeah. Somewhere in a hidden room in the Capitol.
That's how they see the future.
It's just
I think
like
Reince's
having a lease here.
Posting job is going great, don't you?
I think it's going really well.
I would have said that no matter which seat I was in. Well, that's another problem.
Well, I was just wondering about, you know, the idea of one of the things they're trying to show on the Neil side is that there's, you know, systemic problems within the way Travis County did this election. And if that is not proved, even if a few of these votes flip over to Howard and even made it, you know, to Neil rather, and made it Neil's to win, you could get a report that said, you know what, when we looked at this specific batch of voters, we flipped enough so that Neil is the winner, but if we looked at another batch, we might flip enough for Howard to be the winner. We don't think this is systemic problems. We're just going to call it a recount.
There's a third case here. You can say Howard wins. You can say Neil wins. You can say there's too much fuzz here. Let's order a new election.
Yep. And don't you think in the case of a new election, the partisans on both sides would be super energized to turn out?
I do. But what happens there is we've got a legislative session going with a budget, redistricting, a whole bunch of, you know, immigration bills and all of this other stuff, 26 or 28 sunset bills.
Yep.
Whoever wins that election misses a whole bunch of the session. So that part of Travis County, for whatever it's worth, isn't represented for a big chunk of the session.
So what would happen? Howard would, if they ordered a new election, they would say to Howard, don't come back until this is resolved?
Seat's vacated. There was not an election
in November. So then they vacate her. So then do they go back over everything she did and like it wasn't there?
That's my understanding.
So all the bills she filed, all the votes she took, it's like a rainout.
Well, they haven't really
stats don't count.
Yeah, they haven't really taken any votes where she was determinative. So there hadn't been a, you know, 75 to 76 vote.
Well, no, but then Strauss's speaker's vote is.
But so does that make the whole thing harmful for the district? You know, if you basically end up not being represented.
I'm in the district.
If you're after that,
ask me.
If you're after that low water crossing,
you're in the district,
right,
aren't
I'm in
you?
That district,
we're
right.
both constituents of Howard.
Well, but you could
I commute in from Houston.
Probably a fair number of people
so.
Listening to this who just assume we weren't represented.
But you could also argue that if an election is if you get a false result in the election.
That's bad for the district, too.
That's bad for the district as well.
Right. Well, let's see if we can just quickly close with some consensus. A new poll came out this week done by Basleys and Associates, Perry's preferred polling firm. So we assume they know the state pretty well, saying that 70% of Texans support a smoking ban on public indoor spaces, basically including restaurants and bars. And Rodney Ellis and Myra Conover have a bill that they've been pushing for a while now, trying to get this ban in effect. It basically died last session. Is this the year that Texas bans smoking?
What's the percentage? I don't know this. What's the percentage of Texans who don't smoke? Is it about 70-30? I'm curious if any, you know.
If it lines up with the poll.
Any crossover here.
If it lines up with the poll, then it's interesting. People associated with the Tea Party, only 54% of them support the ban. So maybe
well,
they are
heavy smokers.
That's
the libertarian idea, right? That's
smokers.
The, you know, yep. What are you doing telling me what to do? You right. saw the Boehner quote where he said to Chris Wallace.
It's a bad habit. I smoke. Shut up.
Right. Leave me alone. Quit bugging me about
Wallace.
It. Right.
Yeah.
He said it's legal. This is legal. I smoke.
It is.
And get out of my face.
Well, yeah. You know, I think that we're
but
all
we
missing.
We regulate that. Things that are legal all the time.
Yeah, but we're missing the bigger picture. So what's the fiscal note?
Yeah, the fiscal note is nothing.
Right. Really? I thought there was an education component. Maybe.
No, I was talking to Ben about this, and I looked it up to see what last year's fiscal note was to see if there's an education component, and there was not. It was not.
Oh, well, then
so you
sure, it'll pass.
Pass this to please 70% of the people.
Well, right. Is the tobacco lobby consequential these days?
Sure.
So is the tobacco lobby is not going to like this. So you can expect that it's going to not go down without a fight.
I don't think the tobacco lobby is going to fight on this. This usually turns into a fight.
Why?
The people that want to allow this are the ones who fill the patios of their bars and restaurants with people who are drinking beer while they smoke cigarettes and drinking drinks while they're smoking cigarettes. This, you know, the tobacco lobby, the reason there's not a fiscal notice is because they don't think they're going to lose any smokers. They're just going to lose customers at these outdoor venues, and that's really where the fight's been.
Right. This also ties into my favorite Burka blog post of all time, which
I'll just quickly read it verbatim.
The whole post.
Read it in Paul's voice?
No, because I've never spoken to him actually. But I'll say it, and you can do it. But it goes, the Ellis Crown over statewide smoking ban bill may not be dead after all. I don't have any details yet, but I'll let you know if and when I get them.
So he just, what, like.
And did he follow up?
The mashed potatoes on his plate formed the bill. It's like Richard Dreyfuss in Close Encounters.
Since this tripcast, there's been silence. Now we are updating you with this latest development.
Three weird movie cues in one podcast. I think that's pretty good.
All right. For Evan, Ben, Ross, I'm Reeve Hamilton. This was the tripcast. And our producer, Todd. I was trying to carry on the tradition of forgetting about it.
Hey, but wait a minute. What if people want to email us?
If they want to email us, they email podcast@texastribune.org.
Yes, that's podcast complaints. I'll stress complaints.
Or just send them to Reeve's personal email. It's there on the website.
Exactly. His email address is nothinglikeelisehugh@texastribune.org.
Well, go ahead. Wrap it up. Why not?
We didn't just wrap it up there?
Wrap it up, Reeve.
Come on, wrap it up.
Oh. Goodbye. Thanks for coming. Hello and welcome to the Tribcast. How does it go?
Not even close.